Thank you so much, Gabriel, and all the other leaders here at Koinonia Evangelical. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a real gift. My story along these lines starts about 30 years ago. I'm 52, but about 30 years ago, I was a chemistry student at Trinity Western. And in the summer, a friend had said, you should go check out this place in Michigan, get some summer courses. This is this Asobel, it was called. I know, not Arusha. We'll get to Arusha in a minute. But Asobel, it's a Christian environmental school, and they offered summer courses that you could transfer back to your home institution. So I thought, well, okay, I like going to get some, you know, do something different in the summer. Sure, I'll go check it out. And I thought I was going to go for a couple courses, come home, great. And what I got, unexpectedly, was arguably one of the most pivotal experiences of my life, and certainly one of the most emotional. I did not see that coming. I went there and I learned all sorts of things that I had never heard before. You know, learning is exciting, so that's part of the emotion. But sometimes the learning is sobering. So, for instance, I was learning about the state of the planet, the vital signs of our biosphere, for instance. And just a couple of little snapshots, in my lifetime, the population of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians has dropped by 60%. So what that means is, like, where there was a herd of elephants or a flock of geese or a school of salmon that was 100, in my lifetime, that's dropped to 40. So kind of worldwide on average. That's staggering. And this was among the things I was learning. Now, that kind of change, negative change, has an enormous impact on people. This is something else I was learning. So for instance, Stella Simiyu is a Kenyan botanist, a former colleague in Arusha World. Here's what she says. The rural poor, which when she's talking about that, she's talking about billions of people in the world. The rural poor depend directly on the natural resource base upon creation. This is where their pharmacy is. This is where their local supermarket is. This is where their hardware store is. This is, in fact, their fuel station, their power company, their water company. What would happen to you if these things were removed from your local neighborhood? What would happen? I mean, I don't know about you, but in this part of the world, that scenario where all those things are suddenly removed, that's like the flood from a couple years back, or it would be like a wildfire, or it would be like the earthquake that is scheduled to happen sometime. We don't know exactly when. But that's what the rural poor are facing every day because of environmental degradation. And this isn't just the rural poor around the world. Consider this. A few years back, a survey of younger Canadians, 16 to 25, was asked about climate change. And here's what they said. Over half of them reported, this is people in our society, over half of them said climate change makes them feel afraid, sad, anxious, and powerless. More than three quarters said this impacts their overall mental health, and a third of them said it impacts them negatively on a daily basis. And that has led nearly 40% of them to question whether they're even going to have kids. So this environmental degradation has major impacts, both on the rural poor, but even here within our country. And this is the kind of thing I was learning at Asobel. Okay, that's super sobering. On the other hand, another thing I was learning was about Scripture. So for instance, I'd grown up, I went to church, I paid attention, you know, I wasn't new to the biblical story, but I was learning new things. And among them was, okay, so I know, yes, we're created in God's image, Genesis 1:27. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Yeah, I knew that. And there are huge implications of being imago Dei, made in the image of God, for how we treat other people. How we treat other people made in God's image. Huge implications. I gotta treat people with dignity and respect and love and care and, you know, all kinds of things. And I'm gonna assume for the purpose of this sermon, you know all about that. I can't cover everything. That's beyond the scope. But let's look at the next verse. Verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. Okay, so we're imago Dei, we're made in God's image, but this is some of what we're supposed to do. Be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the creatures. Okay, what are the implications for how we treat God's creatures, the non-human world? Yes, rule and subdue, but also we're supposed to be fruitful and increase and fill. But here's something that I didn't include in the scriptures that I just pointed out. If you look a couple verses earlier, the fish, the birds, and the animals are also called to be fruitful and increase and fill the earth. So whatever it means to image God, whatever it means for us to exercise rule and to subdue, and whatever it means for us to be fruitful and to multiply and fill the earth, it can't be, the result can't be, biblically speaking, to compromise the ability of other creatures to also be fruitful and increase and fill. It just doesn't work. Both creatures and humans were given these commands. Let's skip forward just slightly. Genesis 2. We're in the garden now, and the very first job God gives to God's image bearers is in verse 15. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. The verbs there, work and take care of, are abad and shamar in Hebrew. And the first one is the same word used when Joshua is leading the Israelites into the promised land, and he's saying, like, no matter whatever happens, no matter what we find, as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. We will abad the Lord. So abad can also be translated serve. And the second verb, shamar, is the same one used in the blessing of Aaron, the one we often use as a benediction. The Lord bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you and give you his peace, so on and so forth. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord bless you and shamar you. So we are called to serve and keep, or serve and protect, you might say, the garden, creation. So this is what it means to be made in God's image. Where the implications for how we treat the non-human world? Well, we can't compromise their ability to be fruitful and increase and fill, and we must be involved in serving and protecting them. But this goes a little bit further. This is the Sunday school answer. Who is the answer to what is our best picture of what it means to image God? Jesus, yes. All Sunday school answers, yes. The answer to all of them is Jesus, yes. And I don't mean that flippantly. Of course, it's true. So let's look at Philippians 2. Here, we have this description of who Christ is. And it says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. Okay, so we're all familiar with the way in which Jesus is Lord. Lord of me, Lord of us. And what do we learn here, though, about how Jesus exercises his lordship? Well, he makes himself a servant, even a servant unto death. He does not use his lordship for his own advantage. He uses it to serve and to enable the flourishing of those under his care. Well, that's the sort of image that we are called to mimic, to be. So maybe I should say a little bit about Arusha. So yes, as Gabriel mentioned, Arusha means the rock in Portuguese. And we have this name because a British couple named Peter Miranda Harris went to southern Portugal to study birds. Peter likes to say he was born with binoculars around his neck, like as in he's a totally manic birder. And if he was standing here today, he probably would hear some bird outside, even in the dark, and be able to tell you what it was. He's crazy. But they went to southern Portugal to study birds and to do that as Christian mission. They got permission from their church's Christian mission agency to go and study birds. Needless to say, in the early 80s, that was unusual. There's not many precedents for that. But that's what they did. And now you fast forward to present day, and there are Arusha projects in over 20 countries around the world. And there's three different provinces in Canada, BC, Manitoba, and Ontario, where we have operations. The local project is based in South Surrey. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. Actually, I do know. I know David has been there. We talked about this just before, but I don't know if anybody else has visited. We'd love to have you come and visit. That would be one of the best outcomes of this night, is if some of you came to visit. That would be lovely. At Arasha, our mission is to live out God's calling to care for creation, some of what I've already outlined, to live out God's calling to care for creation and to equip others to do likewise. We envision a hope-filled world where communities flourish as people and nature thrive together, not this kind of, okay, human sort of thrive at the expense of creation, but no, we're meant to thrive together. This is how God created everything to be. So how do we do that? Well, one of the chief ways we do that is by nurturing biodiversity. Locally in South Surrey, we focus on the Tatulu River, or the Little Campbell River, and its watershed. And we do things like study endangered species, toads, frogs, fish, birds, plants, mussels, and so on. And we create habitat, or we restore habitat, so that there is places for these creatures to live and thrive. One example of this is throughout the watershed and then in the bay, like where the river hits the ocean. It's called Shared Waters Alliance. So for this, we partner with many groups, but in particular, the Semiahmoo First Nation. They have their land right at the estuary. And historically, they had a shell fishery. This part of the ocean is bountiful with shellfish, and this is where they got most of their food. However, since the 70s, it's been outlawed to shellfish there because of contamination. So one of the things Arasha has done is to try to coordinate amongst all manner of stakeholders to, let's find out what's causing the pollution. Okay, we found it. Let's stop it. Let's advocate to stop that. Okay, now we've done that. Like, what can we do to make it healthier and better? In our work doing that, one of the things we found was a Salish sucker. I know, a very ignoble fish, not as kind of iconic as salmon, although the river does have five species of salmon in it, and we do study the salmon as well. But we did find this little fish called Salish sucker, and it's quite threatened. In fact, before we found it, they thought it had been extirpated from this watershed. Extirpated means like extinct in a particular area. So they hadn't seen it in this particular watershed for 40 years. And here it was, we found it. So one of the things we've done is try to create more habitat. And we found more of them, and we search for them, and we cultivate that. Another thing we found as we've worked in the watershed is the European green crab. This was we first discovered this in the estuary about a year ago. And it was the worst news I'd had in a long, long time, because the European green crab is one of the most virulent invasive species in an estuary. It just takes over. They literally eat all the other crabs and creatures that are supposed to be there, and they're not supposed to, like, they come from another place. So one of our jobs now is to try to find them and kill them. So this is part of what conservation can be sometimes. All of this is to help the Semiahmoo. Let's think globally for a minute. So Arasha around the world, one example I want to talk about is Arasha in Ghana. There, the Atawa Forest is globally recognized as a biodiversity hotspot, one of the top places in the whole planet for rich biodiversity. Arasha there, among many other things, has used camera traps to find what creatures are there. A camera trap is you set up in the forest, and there's a trigger, usually some like a laser trigger or something like that, to take a picture. Well, that's what the top left is. I know it's hard to tell, but it's actually a camera trap picture of a white-naped mangabey, the monkey on the right. Well, they didn't know this existed there. They're very rare. They found it. Arasha found it. This is just one example of the dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds, of species that are unique to the Atawa Forest. Moreover, the Atawa Forest is the water source for 5 million Ghanaians, for their agriculture and their drinking water. 5 million, including the capital of Accra. Well, here's what's happening to the Atawa Forest. International mining companies want to mine it for bauxite, a precursor to aluminum. And Arasha Ghana is the lead voice, the lead conservation group. It's kind of like the David Suzuki Foundation of Ghana in the sense of like profile. And they are rallying resistance to this. They are even leading a campaign to take their own government to court to say, hey, we need this. You're supposed to work for us as citizens, not sell it off to somebody else. In London, England, a project that Arasha's been a part of there, it was involved a 40-acre brownfield right next to Heathrow Airport. So you know London, you know Heathrow. Like, think about how badly polluted this would have to be to have 40 acres abandoned next to Heathrow. Well, Arasha was involved with partners there locally, municipality and so forth, to turn this into a park. And now they've been monitoring the return of all kinds of birds and butterflies and insects that weren't there just a few decades ago, and now they're coming back. So this is an example of some of the nurturing biodiversity that is a part of Arash's work. A second part of Arash's work is to empower tomorrow's earth keepers. This happens in all manner of education. So think school groups. We have school groups coming to our local center every week. They're on a field trip, or they're kids' day camps in summertime or in spring break. And it's all hands-on, very experiential, trying to tackle what somebody has dubbed nature deficit disorder. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's a play on the attention deficit disorder. The idea is that so many people in our society have so little access, particularly when they're growing up, to like direct engagement with the natural world. I'm not talking like watching a video on nature. I mean like you're in it, your toes are in the dirt or mud or whatever. And the idea is that developmentally, this is costly. Your development socially, physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, always is compromised without direct contact to nature. So for instance, one of my colleagues, Ruth, she likes to tell the story. They had a group of these kids in. They were doing a unit on composting. In composting, the stars of the show are the detritivores, the critters that take the garbage and turn it into soil, worms. All right, so they were digging in the dirt. This is a hands-on experience. We're going to dig in the dirt. We're going to check out the worms. And Ruth picked up a worm, and she went to hand it to this, like, a 12-year-old, 11-year-old boy. Here, you want to hold the worm? And the boy looked back at her and said, well, I don't know. Does it bite? And the sobering point of this story is that it's possible in our society right now for an 11-year-old boy to have not yet discovered that worms don't bite. I mean, in one sense, it's trivial. On the other hand, I actually think that's a real problem. At some point, that boy is going to be mayor or a business owner or a parent or a teacher or a doctor. That's a problem. That lack of ecological literacy will have consequences in ways that Stella Semiu was talking about, here presently and also globally. So another example of the education we do, my colleague Samuel, who lives right here in Richmond, is right now, as we speak, in Baku, Azerbaijan. Is he in Baku, Azerbaijan? Well, he's there because there's a climate COP. Have you heard of these things? Conference of the Parties. This is like this global gathering. Tens of thousands of people every year gather to try to figure out ways to mitigate climate change. And these are reps from countries all over the world. One of the things that Arash does under Samuel's leadership is partner with a few other organizations. And we make it possible for regular people next year, a year from now, when the next one is happening, which is in Brazil, actually, it could be one of you. You can apply. And we make it possible for you to go there and be in the room where the negotiations are happening. It's quite a remarkable experience. I went to Glasgow and experienced it myself, and it does a great job at equipping people to then go back to wherever they're from and be a witness, be an advocate, to better understand how this is something we should be talking about and caring about. A third way that we do our education, our Empowering Tomorrow Earth Keepers, is through the Tatalu Conservation Residency. This is a kind of earthkeeping apprenticeship program that we run at our local center, and I'm just going to tell a couple of stories of people who have been through that. There's one person from Koinonia who has actually been a part of that. But a different person, not the one from Koinonia. Sarah, she's from Brazil. She was with us recently, and after her time with us, her church has asked her to come back and lead their church's green team. And she's from São Paulo, this enormous megatropolis, right in a very urban setting, but that's what she's going to do. Helen, another woman who came to us, she said, like, I love my church. I've grown up in a church. I love going to youth group and college and career. But I also love biology, and I want to be a marine biologist. And yet, whenever I am in the lab, my lab mates are like, why do you bother with all that church stuff? It doesn't mean anything, right? And when I'm in the youth group or the college and career, all of my friends there, they're going, why do you bother with that biology stuff? When are you going to do something that's actually Christ's work? And she came to us and was like, do I have to choose? Like, is it either or? Like, I love them both. And of course, we're saying, no, you don't have to choose. Of course not. This is part of what it means to be human. This is part of what it means to be Imago Dei, for these things to go together. Sure enough, now she's a marine biologist. Ellie, another woman, came to us. She was studying at UBC. Her profs had done an excellent job of outlining all the ways that the ecological vital signs of the planet are in the toilet. And she came to us despondent. She was despairing. She grew up in church, but her church had not equipped her to understand or to think through, like, how do I live in a world where ecologically it's all going downhill? What does that mean for my life and how I'm supposed to be? And so what she got from Arasha was like community. She got theological equipping. She got trained in spiritual practices that can sustain someone like her who wants a career in that field. And so, yes, she has gone back into it, which is wonderful. A third aspect of what Arasha does is we are trying to ignite creation care in churches. This is particularly near and dear to my heart and a central focus for my particular role, part of the reason why I'm here tonight. One of the things we've done in this regard is we've done conferences at churches. For instance, my colleagues in Winnipeg, they've done this thing called Consider the Lilies, a conference based at a church. Another is a couple times I've hosted a small group from a church in Honolulu. So a Hawaiian church has brought some of their leadership team to us for like a week, and I host them for a week-long immersion at our local center to try to equip them and help cast some vision for them as they are stewarding a remarkable project. They have nearly 250 acres of former golf course. This is used to be a golf course. The church now owns it, and what they want to do is they want to turn it into a nature conservancy. They want to do this as part of the mission of the church. And so they've come to Arasha, and we're trying to kind of coach them on that. Another, far closer to home, right here in Richmond. There's a church here in Richmond that they were looking at their property and noticed the parking lot and all the rain, like tonight, and it rolls off their parking lot, and it goes to the storm drain, and the storm drain has that fish sign beside it, which means the water is going into a fish-bearing stream. And if you know anything about how the parking lots work, there's tons of pollution, all kinds of oil and road grime and stuff. Well, that's really bad for the river. So this church said, hey, what can we do about this? So they contacted their local stream keepers group, and they got some help with designing a rain garden. They contacted their local municipality, the city of Richmond, got a small grant to help buy some materials. They contacted the local public school and had the communications class, high school communications class, come and document like the before and after. And then they had a series of Saturdays, series of weekends, where they had a all church, like intergenerational activity to like, let's turn this small corner patch of barely lawn and a couple of parking stalls that we don't really use, let's turn it into this rain garden that not only filters out pollutants before it gets into the stream, it's now creating habitat for pollinators, butterflies, this kind of thing. Pretty great project. Love it. Well, how does this apply to you, and how does this apply to us? My challenge is, how is God inviting you to be hope in your neighborhood? And by neighborhood, I'm of course including human neighbors, but for the focus of today, I'm actually focused in on non-human neighbors. We have many non-human neighbors. What about them? A few years back, Arasha joined with Tear Fund Canada. Tear Fund is like a Christian relief and development agency. And we did a survey of over 700 Christians in Canada, under 40, so young-ish Christians in Canada. And we asked them about nature and faith and climate and churches and this kind of stuff. And overwhelmingly, the respondents said that caring for creation, they think, is a part of discipleship and Christian mission. The respondent says, this matters to them. They care about it, and it matters to our world. And overwhelmingly, they said, and our churches are mostly silent. That's what they said. Here's a quote from one of them. I think a lot of times people in the church have made loving nature out to be something that's just for a few people. They pass off that creation care piece to a couple of people in the church as if it's just something that one or two people can work out. They're not really recognizing that creation care is an integral part of worship and a calling for all Christians. How is God inviting you, you individually, you as Koinonia, to be hope in your neighborhood? A neighborhood that includes human and non-human neighbors. What might this look like? I want to refer now to a metaphor. So there's a woman named Deborah Reinstra. She wrote a book recently called Refugee of Faith. And she draws for this book on this concept, an ecological concept called refugia. Let's cue this one up. I want this one to be playing now. So refugia is something that scientists discovered when they were looking at devastated landscapes, landscapes devastated by a wildfire or like a volcano where it comes through and there's just, you know, obliteration. And they were asking, like, how long is this going to take to recover? And what they found was they were surprised at how quickly it recovered. It recovered much faster than they thought. And the reason is because there was these little pockets within a mostly devastated landscape that survived. The landscape wasn't dead, it was only mostly dead. I don't know if anybody knows Princess Bride. That was a quote from the... No, okay, sorry. I guess you didn't get that one. So there was these little pockets. They're little bits of refuge, refugia. And they started to be like the seed bank out of which the creatures started to grow and plants started to repopulate the devastated landscape. They hook up, they kind of bridge to each other, and this caused the landscape to recover much more quickly. Well, Reinstra says, like, maybe that's what we're to be. We're to be refugia, refugia faith, the title of her book. Well, one of the things I love about this idea is it's not just a metaphor. Could we be these pockets of refuge in our world? It's not just a metaphor, it's a reality. And you've been looking at some pictures of a place in Ethiopia where this is a reality. There are, it's called the Church Forests of Ethiopia. And there, the landscape is mostly brown, as you're looking at, because of grazers. People there are pressed to poverty. Their cattle and whatnot graze as much as they can because they need food. But what this means is that the landscape is mostly denuded, except for these islands of green, literally islands of green, around which is a small stone wall that keeps out the grazers but allows people in. And at the center of each one of these is a church. At the center of each one is a church. These places are so remarkable that the reason I found out about them is because I was reading in National Geographic about a scientist, an Ethiopian scientist, who's studying these forests as a way to figure out how to restore the ecology and the landscape, the ecological landscape, the forests that used to be there. Here's his quote. "These forests are not just good for people, they are also the last shelter for wild animals. In our tradition, the church is like an ark, a shelter for every kind of creature and plant. If a wildcat or a little kudu or a vervent monkey leaves the church forest, immediately he will be killed, but here the animals are safe." That's Dr. Alawewehu Wasi. So how is God inviting you to be hope? To be a refuge in your neighborhood for, yes, human creatures, of course, but also for non-human creatures? How will you individually and collectively be Imago Dei? To live in a self-sacrificial way that allows those under your care to flourish. Well, a few examples, maybe, to spark your imagination or possibilities. What if we paid attention to the worship of all God's creatures, and then we join in? Think of Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. But the question is, are we listening? Are we joining in them? Are we allowing are we allowing the heavens and the creatures to sing God's glory? Another scene. You remember the scene in John 20? Jesus has just resurrected. He's just come out of the tomb. And Mary comes, and she's looking for Jesus. And do you remember what she says? She says to him, like, "Where have they buried my Lord? Do you know where he is?" And the text, the line, the gospel writer, John, says, "Thinking he was the gardener." Some translations, like, mistaking him for the gardener. Well, my question is, well, why did she think he was the gardener? It seems to me the most obvious kind of straightforward reason is because, well, he was buried in a garden of Arimathea, and he was gardening. The very first thing he did when he came out of the tomb was to tend the garden, which is what the first humans are called to do, to serve and keep the Garden of Eden. Well, maybe he was gardening. Maybe that's why she thought he was the gardener. Well, maybe that's what we are called to do. What does that look like for us? Maybe it could be get to know our neighbors. Yes, our human neighbors, but maybe part of what God is calling us to is to get to know our non-human neighbors. Which of God's creatures share this place with you? Be curious. What do they need? What do they offer you? One of the ways I've tried to cultivate this is I have a couple of places that I just in you know a trail or a walk or a beach or something that I just go to regularly. And one of the things I've noticed recently when I've gone in the last couple of months is the mushrooms are just exploding. There are dozens of different types of mushrooms, and they're I can't explain it any other way. They just exploded. They're everywhere. Well, if I didn't go for a walk, I wouldn't notice that. I don't know their names. I'm not a mycologist, but at least I'm curious and I'm wondering about them. And I'm like, yeah, I learned a little bit about mushrooms and mycelium and how crucial they are for forests. What could that be part of what it means to pay attention to join creation in its praise? What about starting a garden? What about tending a garden? There is wonder all around us for those that have eyes to see. Lastly, of course, a little shameless plug. Of course, we'd love you to join in with Arasha. But even more, I'd love to come alongside people at Koinonia and see what's possible here. What's possible in Richmond, where you are. Even better. I mean, of course, I'd love to come to Arasha. And you already are doing something in the sense that, as Gabriel mentioned, you are supporting Arasha. I have to say, we have lots of faithful supporters and donors to Arasha, but not many churches. So thank you so much for being one that is. I'm going to close now. I'm going to close with this short excerpt that I want to read from a participant in our residency program. So this is a woman. She was with us for like 6 months. She was immersing herself in the life of Arasha, which is a kind of refugia, a place where we're trying to know our place and live accordingly. And I want you to hear her words and imagine how what she says about Arasha could also be true of your life and of the life of this church. Here's what she says. I have spent my entire, and I should also add, I wonder to what extent what she's describing resonates with some of you or resonates with some of the people that you know. So think of it in that way too. I have spent my entire adult life oscillating between frantic and unrealistic attempts at saving the world and crippling despair. This strategy has left me restless, hopeless, and ultimately lifeless. Today, I itch to tangibly care for creation, but most days I am simply too tired. Life has been far from a fairy tale, and so I distrust them. The picture is usually painted in broad brushstrokes that gloss over the complexities of life. The story is often one of either ignorance or escapism. I have been expecting this fantastical land of Arasha to be at least one of these things, but once again I stand corrected. I have found myself dwelling in a place where hope is founded, delight is genuine, and rest is a given. This is not some naive escape from the harshness of life. If anything, it exists as a direct response to the surrounding predicament in which the world is found. Throughout my time here, I have acquired no simple conclusions to any of my questions, hurts, and dreams, and this I appreciate. I possess no patience for such things. However, I am learning to hope, learning to rest, maybe even learning to live. Being blessed into loving the land and to do this alongside others has done wonders to my being. I have seen abundant harvests cultivated from this hallowed land. I have tasted radical generosity in the form of grace, understanding, and blueberries. I have felt pieces of my being made whole while listening to children fall in love with creation care. I've been held captive by the aroma of this community, a resilient and committed community. This is no fairy tale. It is a very real piece of a very different sort of kingdom. May it be so in our communities too. Amen.